Hey everyone, Steven here, and welcome to episode number 9 of You Are Admirable. In this installment, we're chatting with Eric Funk of award-winning PBS TV show 11th and Grant fame, Montana State University fame, and other extensive music fame. I think the best way to describe Eric would be musical genius, and after this interview, I would also call him a life genius. He's been all over the world and has some really incredible stories to share, and I'm so thrilled I got the opportunity to interview him. Let's jump into it. What's your creative process? Where does the creativity spring from? Where do you find inspiration? And I've listened to a few of your interviews, and it seems like a lot of it is going out into nature, the vast expanse of Montana allowing you to kind of listen to the music that's within you and the music that is you. And the part that I'm most curious about is, if you know what gave or what gives birth to it all, and if you had to work very hard at it, or if it's just kind of an innate ability that you have.
You know, I think we're born with it. I tell my students, and I get the strangest looks back, but I'll say, you know, I think every one of us is born an iPod, and we're full of original information. And if you can tap into it, it's just there, and it's stuff that's not out here. And it's stuff that isn't derivative. You're not taking stuff out of here and repackaging and sort of mashing it up and then redelivering. But it's actually original. Whether you're an engineer and you're inventing, a builder, an architect, a painter, a sculptor, you just imagine things that are like in there. And I think that's the trigger. It's abstract, but it's about as close as I've been able to come to something that explains this thing. And then if, you know, as I tell them, it's not magical thinking, because just because you can imagine it doesn't mean that you can manifest it. You have to have some skill set.
Yeah.
And so the trick is, once you get more seasoned at this, is to take the quantum leap each time, so that the next thing that you're doing is almost out of reach, but it's still within reach. You can get kind of a feeling for this, like, I think I can do this. But you don't want to do something that's too close in, because then you can kind of get in a rut and it can be too duplicative.
Yeah.
But if you have the courage to make that big reach, you get into, I mean, it's really interesting. Some of it comes from dream, you know, from dreaming overnight. And that lucid state, you know, that sort of in between wake and sleep. I remember one of the things I did was it was called A Glimpse Soliloquy in a Forest, and it was a ballet, but the dancers in the imagery were creating music by dancing through light beams. And it was such a beautiful kinetic art form that now I was stuck with the, all right, how do I do this? I'm not an inventor. I don't know how to do this. And I sort of just kind of kept, let it cook, kind of let it percolate. And I ran into some people, and I was sharing the idea, and this guy said, oh, you have to meet this friend of mine. He's a research scientist at the University of Washington Medical Labs, and he's basically an inventor, North Korean guy, who had, you know, way back had come to the U.S. and ended up in this position. His name was Kyum Ha Lee. And so I meet him, and I tell him what I want to do. And he said, you know, it sounds like what you need is a shadow-activated volume control, so that the light beam, he said, like the light beam that opens an automatic door in a supermarket from you breaking the beam. But in this case, what it does is it turns the volume up of sound that's already going in like 3 milliseconds, so that the illusion is that touching the light beam is creating the sound. So he built this linear amplifier for me before they were even around, in this little funky prototype box. And I had about 5 miles of cable that came with this, and he had taken little tiny light sensors and embedded them in the barrels of ink pens that he'd taken apart, because he had to have some sort of a holder. Mm-hmm. And he took it out of the SeaTac airport and tested it 1 mile to see if the light shining, and if you broke that light at that distance, if it would sense it, and it did. So we knew we had that part, and so I thought, okay, so what I need to do now is I need to reflect these light beams off of something, because we're going to be in a smaller space. So on the marley floor that dancers dance on, I went to an Army Surplus store and I bought some Army Surplus metal mirrors and I gaff taped them to the floor. And then I shot the lights down, bounced them off the mirror into the sensor. And then we flooded the whole stage with oil smoke. So it was like fog. And you could see these beams of light. And these dancers come out into this sort of quasi-light forest. And the audience is just seeing this sort of silent procession. And meanwhile, I've got a reel-to-reel tape recorder that's running six tracks of music constantly at full volume, but you can't hear anything. Because the volume on each one is turned up full, but until you turn it up with a light beam, it's nothing. And so as soon as they start to enter one of these light beams, you get this ba-da-da. As long as they're in there, it'll just take a fragment. So point being, the long story, the point being is that you have the image, and if it's enough of a passion trigger for you, you can't let it go. It keeps bugging you. It's like you've got to figure out a way to do this.
It's more about the imagination than like a talent or a skill. It's envisioning something and then kind of figuring out how to get there, yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you look at everything that's human-made, it wouldn't be here if somebody didn't have the wherewithal to create it in some form. So I think the germ in that little fractal of a thought gets sort of planted, and then how your own brain sort of personifies this thing, you know, what it becomes is sort of left up in the air. So I guess the big question, when I was younger, I used to think they were out there somewhere and that each one of us was like a lens, and that if we started paying attention to the ether, that you could get this stuff to kind of pass through. You could reach for it as it was reaching for you. And it's a nice model. It's a nice imagery, just because there's no such thing as writer's block if you're not the source, if you're just the lens. So that was kind of a nice way to work, because really all you ever had to do if you felt like you were disconnected was polish the lens, right?
Yeah.
Just make sure that you had a way of drawing this stuff in. And then it gets to the point where it doesn't really matter where it comes from. But I know in those early works, I go back and I'll look at my early compositions, lots of times my name's not on it because I didn't feel like I could have ownership for something that I just channeled. I mean, it was that weird. I thought, God, I can't put my name on this. I'm just a scribe. You know, that was kind of the way that I viewed it. But I think my family, with both parents being professional musicians, and all four of us kids being professional musicians, having had a 2.5-hour concert that we did in uniforms that had 6-part a cappella singing, and then everybody played 3 instruments. We had all these different combinations. Because my parents were opera singers, them coming down to wake you up and singing It's Opera Day meant that you had to sing everything. You had to sing for the cereal and the toast, and your brother's in the bathroom and you have to get to school, and you're singing, you know, when are you going to get out of the bathroom, and he's singing back to back off. And so you have this whole, I mean, our life was so Addams Family like and so musical. Everything was just music.
Yeah,
it's really weird even looking back, because Dad was a real athlete and he really wanted my brother and I not to be musicians. He wanted us to be athletes. So we were kind of pitted against each other and very competitive. But playing tennis, playing basketball, whatever we were doing, we were really aware of the timing and the rhythm, you know, and that's kind of what held it together. Sort of weird thought frames that were very musical.
Yeah.
As a model. So what I'm trying to get to here is, I think musicians like us and musicians that I've met, there's this factor X, if you will, that they're born with. It's just like this thing. You can't really just chip away at this stuff and make it happen. There has to be something that's already there. And then I use that for my students. I use that Einstein quote, the brighter the light, the bigger the proportionate darkness. Mm. So as you grow musically, you become more aware of what you can't do and how big the realm is that you're always operating in. And you have to remember to look back at what you have done so you don't get diminished by the immensity of that which hasn't yet been created.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a very, it's almost esoteric, and it's really difficult to explain because as a musician, music is my language, and I've been hearing music in my head since that I was aware of that wasn't music out here since I was maybe 3. And so once you realize that what you're hearing isn't a signal that's external, then you start trying to figure out a way to grab it, poke it out on the piano or a guitar or something.
Yeah.
And you talk to somebody and they go, I don't understand, you know, how that works. But I can say, okay, what if you're walking in the woods? And one of the reasons I go into nature is because it's so, I can't be interrupted. You know, I'm just in it. And it's a very abstract place for me. The sky itself has a sound of sorts, not literal sound, but there's a feeling tone to it, it's a sanctuary within which one can work. So if you were walking out there and you started to imagine this story and you tell yourself the story while you're walking, every character, every scene, every detail of the characters that are in the story come up in your mind. And by the time you get to the end of it, all you really have to do is sit down and write it down, because you've got every single detail. And then as you start to really think about it, you wonder, you say, well, they're in this back room of this building. What does this building look like from the outside? So now you got to describe it, but you know what it looks like because you were inside of it, right? So as a composer, you're hearing the whole piece of music like you imagine a whole story, but because music is the language that is your language, it makes as much sense as it does for somebody who's learned how to speak and write and read to use that language to express something. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. It really reminds me of, did you see that movie? I think it's called The Arrival. Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of that concept. And I had heard the concept before I saw the movie, but about how if you, depending on your language, you're better at different things. And of course, the idea in that movie is that if you learn their language, then you can see the future and that sort of thing. But you have the language of music, and it allows you to see things in that way.
Yeah, and I finally wrote a book for the classes I teach at Montana State called Sound Thinking. It's all music, how music connects everything with everything. And so my students, like right now, are finishing up their semester papers, and they have to say how chemical engineering or biofilm or whatever they're majoring in is music. There is a melody, there's a rhythm, there's a harmony, there's a form, there's an overarching sound. There are dynamics at every level, interactive levels, but also just the dynamics of space. And getting them to think about that, the rhythm of everything, the rhythm of you. You can't really do anything a cappella if you're alive, because you're in an environment. You're being accompanied, even if it's by what seems to be a relative silence.
Yeah.
And so once you start paying attention to that and you start hearing everything, and how it moves, how it has a visual and it has an aural thing. That's life on Earth. I mean, it's kind of the nature of it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And to be honest, the most abstract thing that I don't normally try to explain to anybody, but since we're going down this road,
yeah.
is that when you hear a piece of music, or at least when I hear a piece of music from beginning to end, sort of full on, the sounds that are there aren't sounds that are on the earth. They're not like violins or guitars, or they're just sounds. And some of them are closer to hamburger than they are to music. So now you're dealing with this sort of density and this texture that has a sound. And then you have to think, how am I going to make this sound with the instruments that we have available on the planet? And I've never wanted to go down the electronic music scene because there's a surfeit of options there, but it seems impersonal. And because one of my teachers was Krzysztof Penderecki, and he was dealing with these idiomatic sounds, and I was listening to his recordings, and I thought, he's got to be using electronics. You can't make these sounds with acoustic instruments. And so when he accepted me as a student, I really went to learn that, to learn his vocabulary and his notation. And sure enough, he had found ways of making these sounds. And probably he was in the same boat as me. It's like, I'm hearing these sounds, but I don't know how to do it. So how am I going to do this? And so you start doing creative orchestrational techniques and mixing things. And you can go real left brain on this, but ultimately, it's got to come out of this imaginal affective domain, if you're going to be able to stay on its scent.
Yeah.
And there's this optimal distance that I always feel where you're just the perfect distance from the truth. You're not too close and you're not too far away. So you can intuit what it is, but you can't say what it is. And it's just, it's like the zone, what we'd call the zone.
Yeah.
And once you learn how to hold that spot, you can go there real fast, like in a thought. And suddenly you're in that place and you just like all channels open and you're really paying attention. And so for me, nature is a great place to do that where I just take off. But what I'm doing is I'm not really hiking. I'm just listening.
Yeah.
But the other way I'll do it is go to the busiest place I can find where there's the most distraction and the most noise, because that becomes neutral nothing as well, as opposed to going to a library where it wants to be quiet, but there's these little sounds. You just hear every little thing, and that's awful.
Yeah.
And so you go to the din, and the din is like the nothing. They're kind of like reflections of the same.
The same thing, yeah. You mentioned Penderecki. Your higher education was in Oregon, and Svoboda was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then was Ferris and Penderecki there too?
It was a strange... Talk about synchronicity. I mean, it makes you sort of believe in... what's his name? Who did the mythology stuff?
Kyle would know.
Yeah, it'll come to me as I tell my... I'm teaching some retired folks right now, and I said, you know what? When something just you can't get it, just remember that your memory is like a lake. It hasn't gone; it's just dived, and it will come back to the surface if you just wait for it. But anyway, what he was saying is, if you follow your bliss, that doors will open for you no matter that are just specific to you. In other words, if you sort of go down that thing. Now I can't remember why I was talking about that.
Oh, because of Svoboda, Ferris, and...
So I was at Portland State as an undergraduate, and I was about ready to go to the University of Washington, and I had done all the paperwork. And Svoboda gets hired, and he comes on, and it's like there was just an immediate affinity. I mean, here's this. He was just a phenomenal child prodigy, very Asperger's-like,
mm-hmm.
High-functioning, extremely brilliant, grandmaster chess player, postal chess champion for years and years and years. Really interesting. And he didn't speak English very well. And so he was imparting to me, through one-syllable words, very complex principles. And in a way... It's like that concept that education comes from the word educare, which means to bring out, not to put in. So I felt like he was reminding me of things that I knew. He was just kind of pulling things to the surface.
Yeah.
And so he was there. I stayed and I worked with him. And then I went away and did some grad work. I guess Penderecki's in the middle of this. So there's another story. And this is where doors open. I went to one of my old mentors, who's still living, he's a 95-year-old composer, just brilliant, a real bright star in my life, both he and his wife. In fact, I taught their son, who was high-functioning Asperger's. He was like Rain Man. I mean, literally.
Wow.
He called me by my birthday. I called him by his birthday. And my job was to do creativity with him. Remarkable mind. But anyway, Bill Stalnaker is his name. This is a most amazing man. I had finished studying with Svoboda, and I was kind of on my own. And Bill said, you know, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, I'm not really sure what I should do. And he said, who is a composer who you really respect, but you don't particularly like their music? And I said, oh, probably the first name that comes to mind is Penderecki. And he said, go study with him.
Wow.
And so I'm thinking, well, that's easy for you to say. I'm just this kid from Montana who's been living in Oregon. You know, go study with him, you know, how am I going to pull this off? And so I go home, and I had a recording of the Passion to St. Luke, Penderecki's piece, and on the bottom of the record jacket, in this two-record LP, was this Belwin Mills address in New York, his publisher. So I write him, and I say, you know, my name is Eric Funk, I'm trying to get a hold of Maestro Penderecki to inquire about private study. Totally on a lark. And I get a letter back like a week later, And this letter says, my name is Robert W. Holton. I'm going to be your correspondent between you and Penderecki, who's in near Krakow. That's the easiest way to say it, in Poland right now. But he would like to see scores. Could you send 5 scores? So I'm like, well, this is happening. And so I put him in a thing and I mailed him off. And then I get another letter from Holton saying he'd forward the scores. And pretty soon he writes back and said, Penderecki was very impressed by your work and he would like to meet you in New Haven at the Yale campus. And you'll be his student. So I own a suit, right? And I have a Forest Service backpack because a lot of my buddies, you know, worked in the Forest Service. And I did a lot of mountain climbing and stuff with those guys. So I had a briefcase full of music. I had a Forest Service backpack with my clothes in it. And I had a suit. So I look like Hyman Kaplan. You know, I'm like something out of a funky movie. And I get on an airplane. First time I'd been on an airplane. And I fly to New York. And I get off this plane. I don't even remember how I got into town, but I'm like, you know, I'm just memorizing landscape like you would in the woods because I don't know where I am. And I don't know where New Haven is compared to New York. I don't know if it's north or south or east or west. I mean, I'm that green. And I'm walking around and finally I come to somebody and said, can you tell me where the Continental Bus Terminal is? Because in those days it was Continental Trailways and Greyhound. And so he tells me, I mean, just people were so friendly and so helpful. I mean, I was like so naive. I could have been taken for a ride, right? But anyway, everybody was really wonderful, and they sent me off to the, you know, the directions, and I went and bought a bus ticket, and I went down to New Haven, and I didn't have any place to stay. I hadn't made any plans at all. I'm just going there because they said you need to meet him there. And so I have money, like $300. And so I check into like a hotel downtown. It's like expensive, so I know I'm not going to be able to do this more than like one night, so I'm going to have to go out and figure this out. And so I'm going to head over to the Yale campus and meet him, and I kind of know where to go, but I'm, again, asking people for directions. And I go downstairs and I'm dressed up. I've got my suit on, about a couple of ties, so I had some change, right? And I walk across the street and I'm dripping wet. I'd never been in humidity before.
Oh, yeah.
And I cross the street and I'm like drenched and I'm going like, oh, this isn't going to work. So I go back and I shower and I dry and I put a different shirt on, a different tie, and I come back down and I'm drenched again because I'm learning, you know, it isn't going to make any difference. So anyway, I walk around and I finally walk around neighborhoods over by the Yale campus and kind of get my bearings where the School of Music is. And they had their own music library, like 3 stories, just music books and scores and records. And wow. I was like, I just walked into Mecca, you know, for me. And I went and did enough research in there to see that they had every score and every recording of everything that he'd written up to that point. And so I wasn't sure exactly what time he was going to arrive, where he was going to be when he did arrive, so I just went and talked to the front office, walked around, saw the sort of derelict house, big old house, going to run down with a refrigerator and a burnt couch in the yard, no grass. And I went and talked to these guys and said, have you got a room that I could rent? And I think the rate was like $25 a week or something like that. And so I ended up staying there. And I was really nervous when I met him. We had this, first started talking in German, then I realized his English was good enough that we could just go that way. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'd like you to write a string quartet. He looked through, we talked about my scores, and I brought some scores at Svoboda, too, because he was my mentor. And I promised Tom that I would share his music. And he wasn't that interested in Tom's stuff. He was like focused on me. And so he said, I'd like you to write a string quartet. And I think, because I'm such an American kid. I think, okay, I'm going to impress this guy. And I stay up all night, and I write a string quartet using his notation, which I had learned before he arrived by listening to all of his stuff. And I went, like, ready. I'm the star pupil, motivated. And so he goes, the next day we have a lesson for a couple hours, and he looks through the whole thing, and he really likes it. And he said, okay, now I'd like you to write. And I thought, oh my God, he's not impressed. He thinks I can write a piece a day. I'll be dead by Thursday. You know, it was that kind of a deal. So pretty soon I'm kind of getting jumpy because I'm seeing him every day for like a 2-hour lesson, and I only have $300, and I've already spent a little bit, and I had a credit card so I could put the room on that, but I wasn't supposed to spend the credit card, and I had a little bit of cash, and I'm kind of thinking, like, I have to eat, and so I'm kind of like getting a little jumpy, and so finally I said, you know, I just need to ask you what my lesson fees are so I know how often we can meet, and he said, no, there's no charge. He said, you're my only student. I'm only here to work with you. And it's like so bizarre. And so then I dug in, and then it got to a kind of a funky spot where we had worked together for so long and so intensely, and he invited me to come to Poland. He owns a castle, and I could go to Poland and live there and continue to kind of be like a protege. And it was the first time I had to make like an adult decision.
Yeah.
Where I'm thinking, I've accomplished what I've wanted to accomplish with him. There's nothing else to learn because my foundational teaching was so strong. And then it was after that that I met up with Sandor Barish. And the fun thing about him was, here's Svoboda, he's Czech. And he's like, not just your teacher, he's running your life, telling you what to eat, you know, who to date, just everything. Everything that's wrong with your life, he's going to fix it. Wow. So it's like very invasive. And so Penderecki is this very elegant, very sophisticated, interesting man, very spiritual, not religious per se, but you just feel the sort of vibe and really into the world of sound. And so now I'm going to work with this Hungarian guy, Veres. And it turns out that he was a colleague and a protege of Béla Bartók. And it was those two who together had gone with Tibor Sherley into the mountains and written down all of this folk music, Hungarian folk music. And so I was going to go, he was living in Geneva, I was going to go study with him, but the same kind of thing happened. Got to the point where I tapped the resource enough that it was my own style, I was growing and individuating, and I was starting to emerge from the principal teacher and these other two and the input from both of them. Joseph Campbell was the author of the mythology.
Oh, nice.
Stuff.
There it goes.
Yeah, and so it's that sort of hero's journey type construct. But, you know, how synchronous. I mean, how is it that a guy from Deer Lodge, Montana, who goes to Portland State, and then one of his mentors says, you should go study with Penderecki, writes down the address on a record album, writes to him, and suddenly you're there. I mean, it was that seemed to me magical. It was like everything was happening because I was responding to cues, and it was like it's supposed to happen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, very unusual.
Doors just open for you.
Yeah.
So with doors opening, one of the doors that's open for you is 11th and Grant. So you are the host and the artistic director. And I was trying to look it up. Was it Gomez's idea in the beginning? So how did 11th and Grant come about, and how is it that you are the face of 11th and Grant now?
Well, it was an interesting thing. If we go way back, like 15, 18 years ago, Montana PBS was just starting to produce their own shows, as far as I knew. And I had a jazz quartet called Backburner in those days. And it was me and Mike Gillen, Eddie T, and Alan Falk. And the four of us played at the Robin like every Friday night. It was like a real going thing, and we just loved it, and it was great. And we got contacted by PBS, and Gomez wasn't on the scene yet. At least I didn't know him. And they asked us if we would do a Christmas special. And we had just done a Christmas album. It was our first album, where we took things like Silent Night, but we did it like take five. We set that groove pocket up, and we made this really, because a lot of jazz Christmas albums are really depressing, just make you want to shoot yourself. So we wanted to do, you know, something that was alive and beautiful and interesting, but had the Christmas repertoire. So we did a show for Montana PBS called A Jazz Piece, P-E-A-C-E, and people loved it, and they aired it for a year, maybe 2 years. And I got a call from Lisa Titus and Gomez, Ruthier, and they said, we want to go to Casa Sanchez and pitch an idea to you. And so we went in there, and we sat down and introduced ourselves. And Gomez said he'd seen the jazz piece, and he loved it. He was a total jazz nut. And then he talked about where he'd grown up and all the great jazz artists he'd heard. And we're talking, and he said, I'd really like to do a Montana PBS jazz show. And my response was, if we do a jazz show, it's going to be to too limited of an audience. But if we go all Montana, all music, then I think we're going to have something that'd be really interesting. And part of that was inspired by back in the day when I'd been music department chair at a couple of different colleges, and I had formed this ad hoc committee, and it seemed like wherever I would move, I'd keep my ad hoc committee in contact as my advisor group. One of those guys was a guy named Hal Cook, who I'd met when I was living on Orcas Island for 5 years, and he had been the editor of Billboard magazine for, God, 40, 50 years. And he told me one time over coffee, he said, you know, somebody in every state needs to rake all the talent to the middle and present it, produce it in some way, because record companies, there's no way they're going to get to the bottom of this. The world's too big. And so with that in the back of my mind, when they're hitting me with this idea, I'm thinking, every little town in this state is going to have a couple of bands. They're going to have these musicians in all these different genres. And I know enough of them that I know I can get a good start on this, you know, without really having a sense of what it was going to look like yet. But it, now that it was all genres, I could kind of start going. And so the first season, it was interesting to me because I used Jenny Fleming. I used my own group, Backburner. I used Phil Auberg. And to me, these were all different genres. But when people saw it, they called it a jazz show. And I thought, oh, no, I don't want it to be a jazz show. I want it to be this other thing. And to me, everybody wasn't doing what I would call jazz. It was sort of a narrower definition, maybe jazz-inspired or jazz-influenced. And so the next year I fanned out even broader, and then pretty soon I just started fanning way out, you know, to country rock and Celtic and bluegrass, and we're a microcosm of the planet. So yeah, any music that's anywhere, we're going to have it here as well, even Zydeco. I mean, it's bizarre. And so that was the beginning, and we didn't have any money to do this show. In those days, Jack Hippa was the sort of head of Montana PBS, and he had offered up the studio and the equipment. So that was huge because, lordy, there's no other way to do this. And then Scott Sterling was new, young guy, and Mike Ballard was on the crew as well, another director. And they just, it was kind of just this piece, we're going to try to do this thing. And so I went out to personal friends, and I said, we're going to do this show, and we need some underwriters. And one of those guys was Jack Ostrowski, and he just took his checkbook out, and he said, how much do you need? And wrote me a five-figure check. And just like, it was like shocking to me. It's just like, nin-nin-nin-nin-nin, and hands it over, and I'm going like, holy smokes. If you're that direct, if you don't pussyfoot around and get awkward and just say, we need your help, what can you do? And so people started taking out their checkbooks. And so the first year we got paid for, but now we're getting ready for season two, and season one was successful. So we're season two. We had to have a cutoff date where we'd sort of figured out our budget and who our camera guys were going to be. But we had to figure out how we were going to pay them. We didn't have any money. And so we'd say, okay, let's knock on doors. Let's make some calls. And that's where Gomez is so good because he's such a decent, he's a very complicated and wonderful, wonderfully philosophic, even though he plays a sort of a tough guy. He's got this really elegant and eloquent side to him. And he's a truth teller. So when he goes out and talks to people, they trust him. And so he would go ask banker friends and business friends. And, you know, between him and Aaron Pruitt, they started being the money raker enters. We used some of the people that had jumped on before. But we said, okay, if we don't have the money by May 15, no season. And so we're scrambling. We're knocking on doors. So season two, we pulled it off. Third season, we're not going to make it. And that's the make or break, because you figure if you get five, now you're a living creature. But so the third season, you know, they don't, what I get paid is just silly. I mean, when people say, oh, man, do you get paid a lot? It's like, you tell them, they go like, really? That's embarrassing. But I said, how about, I won't take any pay for season three. I said, let's just, if we can get people to just say, okay, let's do this on a shoestring. Because I think if we get past season three, we're going to be. And once we did, then pretty soon we weren't knocking on doors. People were knocking on our door, which was great because the show had sort of a little bit of a following. And then Montana being Montana, or maybe this is true everywhere, but certainly true in Montana, people had never seen any of it, and they see one episode, and they think they've discovered it. And it's like, wow, have you seen this show? And then you get into these funny, I get into arguments. People say, I saw your 11th and Grant show, so you shoot that in Billings, right? And I go, no, we shoot it right here in Bozeman on the corner of 11th and Grant on the Montana State campus. They go, no, no, you don't, because Yellowstone Public Radio is in Billings. And I said, it's not a radio show. Because if you've seen it, you know that it's actually on TV. And they're arguing with you about something that you're doing. I mean, it's the weirdest feeling that your truth is not the truth. Your reality construct is totally wrong. And it's a strange... I mean, you almost start laughing. It's like, gee, should we get in the car and I'll take you over there and show you what this looks like? But, yeah, it just kind of grew. And then, you know, at first I'd contact people and maybe... All the way up through season 6, I might contact a band and say, you know, we've got this TV show, it's called 11th and Grant with Eric Funk, and I'm the host and the artistic director, and basically it's an hour show, 45 minutes of music, 15 minutes of interview, and we'd like you to be on it. Well, they don't know if it's cable access. I mean, they have a very limited understanding of what Montana PBS is and what the quality, what the production values are. And so... They might agree to do it, but they're not really sure. Or they show up and they don't have any concept. And then they come in there and it's like, holy smokes. We've got David Ray on one of the cameras who was videographer with the Rolling Stones for 12 years. I mean, the guy, he is passionate about his industry. I remember sitting with him on a break and he had his laptop. And he's showing me his camera angle of a James Taylor tribute with Alison Krauss and the JT backup band, and he's weeping because the shot's so beautiful. I mean, and I thought, this is who we work with. You know, it's a, he has the same kind of emotional connection with the artistry of his thing. And I remember one of our rap parties, we had a picnic out at Eric Hippa's house, and he got up and he gave a talk, and he said, you know, as a camera guy, I never even meet the producer or the director. And he said, we're just treated like we're not even there. And he said, I just feel like I'm part of a family here. I mean, that, and so these guys, you know, they want to do it because they love the show. They love the way they're treated. We shoot 6 shows in 6 days back to back. And it's like intense. Makeup at 7:30 in the morning and then a final sound check and then shoot for 8 hours. And they load out. The next guys load in. We do a new light stage and a quick sound check and do it again. And here we are. Now we've shot season 12.
Wow.
Isn't it amazing? 12 years.
Yeah. That's a good show.
Thanks.
And my parents wanted to make sure that I said that they love it. And
oh,
they
good.
Do. It's one of the shows that I always noticed. They don't DVR much, but it's a show that they always, like, it's on their list of things that they download and always check out.
So. It's so amazing. I mean, really, we decided, one of the things that was asked early on in one of the meetings was, you know, should we have a live audience? And I said, trust me. With Montanans, you don't want a live audience because they won't have any facial affect. It'll be all inward turned. And if they're sitting in an audience and you put a camera on them, they're going to be... Because they're listening. And actually, I think it's one of the things that helped us in the last 4 years now. We've won the award for the best entertainment show in the United States, regardless of market size. So basically, we've just dusted Austin City Limits 4 years in a row. And I think one of the reasons is, and when you read the adjudicator's comments... We don't have a live audience, so we can get up really tight on a shot, and we can show so much personality and affect that the viewing audience, the live audience, is at home. And so they're having this experience that they're encountering a music that they may think, I don't like this kind of music, but I like that.
Yeah.
And that's part of it's just that personal nature, because when I do the interviews, there's no plan. And, you know, musicians are the kind of people that say, would you give me a script of the questions? And I say, I have no idea. You know, this is coffee in the kitchen. This is Montana, old school, you know, where you come over and we pour a cup of coffee and we just start talking.
Yeah.
And we let it go where it goes. And I do like 35 minutes of interview with each individual. And then we take 1 minute. And I'm never going technical unless it just takes me that way. It's always, I'm trying to figure out a way to expose personality and affect. So that the people who are watching it feel like, I know this guy.
Yeah.
And they get a sense of, sort of, it gets rid of the myth around musicians being a bunch of stoners or, you know, people without any kind of direction. And they suddenly are encountering this intelligent person with a marketing strategy or a deep love of humanity. I mean, these things start to emerge. And even musicians that I've known for a long time, when I get them in interview, suddenly they just start opening like time-lapse flowers. And it's like, geez, you know, I had no idea that you went to that well. And it's very, very cool.
Yeah.
And so what we started to find out was that the interviews would reveal a kind of a storyline that we had no idea was there. And that would then sort of guide the order of the pieces, because we don't shoot them in the order or show them in the order that we shoot them. And Scott's just real masterful. Once Mike Ballard moved and took a gig over in Idaho, it's all fallen on Scott. And he has this wonderful intuitive sense. While he's not a musician, he's exceptionally musical. Mm-hmm. Gomez and I will get all the interview footage separate. He gets his at his house, I get mine at my house. We both look at them, we write down time codes of what we think are the keeper spots. They're always exactly the same, given give or take a millisecond. I mean, it's just laughable at this point. We both show him, we've got our notes, and I'll say, so 15:32, and he goes, 0.48, and I go, yeah, and he said, and it stops here, and I go, well, I went a little farther. He said, well, I went that far, I have it in parentheses, because maybe, I mean, this is, we're having these arguments about the same spot, but it was our way of proving, you know, to ourselves that it was a proving ground of what we think the public is going to go like, whoa.
That's great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And so this formula, this sort of guys in the kitchen formula, it has just worked.
Nice.
It's never gotten too slick. It's kept that sort of family vibe of us being there. I'm on set on all these shoots, and every time the band finishes a number, I go out and talk to them about it. Sometimes I'll go musical and say, you know, could you, any chance you could just kick the tempo forward just a little bit, kind of like a more of like a producer on a record album. But we don't want to make it a recording session. We want it to be live. And so I say, you know, think of this as a gig. You're out at Pine Creek. You're playing this gig. You don't get done with the song and say, oh, shoot, we need to do it again. Because you wouldn't do that in a gig. I mean, it is what it is. So let's try to keep it real. But we'll oftentimes do two takes. And so I'll go out and give them reinforcement and put them at ease and let them know what worked. And because I've done so many different kinds of music, they're dealing with a musician, so they trust me, mm-hmm. which makes it work really, really well. And then in the interview, it's a total gas because they drop their guard. Most musicians are introverts, and the last thing they want to do is be around other people. And so, you know, once they realize, like, guitar players are the most introverted of the musicians. And so I know that if I try to talk to them, they're just going to be presenting themselves like stone man or stone woman. And so, you know, usually about three sentences, and I say, so way back when, what was your first guitar? It's just like a child. It's like you've reminded them of Christmas. They go, oh, I had this little red Stella. You know, it's really kind of a crappy guitar, but I love that guitar. I said, and so you play that for a while, and then what did you get? Well, then I really got in. I got this thing. And pretty soon they're like in dreamland. They don't even know the cameras are there anymore, and they're just talking away.
Yeah.
But it's because I kind of know that world, you know, playing guitar, playing bass, playing drums, playing keyboards, I can go down those roads. And in the old days, I used to play one tune with every band on those early shows, which was fun, but it started feeling like Captain Kangaroo. You know, I just felt like it was like a shtick.
Yeah.
And so I said, you know, they're going to lose one of the songs from their set list because they have to include me in it. And it felt a little like Marion McPartland meets Captain Kangaroo. So I said, let's do it situationally. And I stopped doing it, and then every once in a while I would jump in on something.
Nice.
Yeah.
This is definitely a selfish question, but was there a time where you were not comfortable on camera, or have you always felt comfortable on camera?
I think I've always felt really comfortable on it, just because, you know, at least the kind of musician I am, it's all about telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And I think if you were nervous about a camera, it would be probably because you had something to hide. You just feel like, oh, shoot, you know, I'd feel awkward or feel like you had to do some presentiment. But I've just never really thought about it.
Interesting.
You know, it just always feels pretty easy to me.
Good.
This conversation is just like, you know, you and I are just talking. We're just being straight with each other.
I want to go back to some of the interviews that I've read with you. And one in particular, you said that the character trait you admire most is making people feel good for being with you. And I wondered if you could elaborate on what that means to you and how you imagine that being accomplished.
Well, probably the easiest way to start entering into that topic is something that I said after we did the screening of The Violin Alone at the Ellen Theater, when I told the audience that I tended to surround myself with in-breath people, that when you hit them with an idea, they go, as opposed to all those people go, you know, the sort of Eeyores of the world. So some of it is that, and then I've found that there are some people that when you're around them, you feel exhausted afterward. They feel great, but you feel like totally sapped. And it's just like they've just kind of come and dredged your entire energy supply. And then there are those people that you look forward to seeing. You don't duck them on the street. I mean, you see them coming and you're so happy to see them, because when you hang with them and you go directly into a conversation, it can be totally shallow and meaningless, or it can be substantive and very deep. You don't know what it is, but you know it's going to be real, and you really are happy to see them. And in a short encounter or a long encounter, you walk away and you just feel better for having been with them. And I think it's a trait that some people have. I don't know if it's something you can groom. Maybe in my case, because teaching has always been a sidebar, and as time has gone on, I want to impart that which I know. I want to help people learn how to think, don't want to tell them what to think. I mean, I'm sort of the critical thinking arena. But beyond that, there's an entertainment piece to this, where you have to be able to engage with people and get them to drop their guard and to laugh and to open up and learn. And so there is a certain amount of grooming behaviors. Or, for example, when I was teaching Honors College Texts and Critics type classes, my opening gambit with the students was, in my section, you need to think and speak in questions. And so it disempowers the alpha male or the alpha female from slam dunking the answer and stopping the conversation. So they can't say, and that's why the sky is blue. They have to say, and is that why the sky is blue? And you get this buoyancy. And so when you practice that and you start nurturing young people to do that, in the name of great conversation, you start to sponsor inquiry as a form of knowledge acquisition, the Socratic dialectic. And so what happens is they start to realize the value of that when you're with someone, like you're doing right now. You're asking me questions, and we're engaging around this, and I'm kind of throwing questions back your way in terms of how I answer the question. There are interrogative teasers that are laced in there that allow this sort of liftoff that mm-hmm. makes it alive and exciting. And it makes our time pass very quickly, but at the same time, we can go really, really deep, because in this instance, we're both in a state of wonder. Value is not a noun, it's a verb. Mm-hmm. And so we're both looking in the same direction, and we're kind of wondering, and we're getting a depth of field, a parallax that we're achieving just because of you being one eye and me being the other eye in that binocular vision. If I had a different person, it would be a different thing. And we've all had that experience where you go to a concert or you go to a play or you go to a film with somebody, and you have an experience that's different depending on who you went with. It's the weirdest thing, and I'm not really sure, but I think it has something akin to this.
Yeah.
And so being passionate, being honest about, you know, being passionate about the things that you really care about, being earnest, being playful, not taking things too seriously, but also taking them very seriously, simultaneously. So there's a sort of a playfulness and a disregard in a braid with a very deep respect mm-hmm. for the whole thing. And when you run into somebody who's doing that same thing, it's a magic is afoot. I mean, really, things start to happen, because we've all had those conversations where you don't want the conversation to end because it's so alive and it's so full and rich. And then the next day you think, I've got to get back together with that person because that was amazing, and you can't make it happen again. It's really tricky. But I think once you fall in love with that experience, you can create pathways for that to happen. And if everybody's down and everybody wants to go there, it's more likely to happen than the cast off. It's not going to happen. So what's the point in engaging?
Yeah.
Approach.
Yeah, definitely. That's an incredible character trait. I like that. I've never heard about that before.
I heard it one time. You know, I'd always valued it. And then there was an interview one time with the Beatles. And they were talking about when they first came to the States and how the American press always wants to bring somebody down. And so they're kind of after him. But they're like the Marx Brothers. So this is young British rockers. And they're really imitating American rock and roll. And they don't know why we need them because they're, you know, they have no idea what they're doing. But their manager, George Martin, who just died, he was kind of their producer, just died last year. He said they were the kind of people that you felt better for having been around. And it was the first time I ever heard that statement. And I thought, I love those people. They just lift. And it's not like you go to them for a lift. It's just it's part of who they are. It's part of their persona. And so I think whenever, because we're such an imitative creature, whenever we see something like that that we value, we take it on and we make it part of our persona as well. You start to strive for that. It's part of character and integrity, I think.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why I started this project too. Erin Roberg is absolutely that person for me. She's a director and she was my second interview, I think. But she is absolutely that person that was like, I want to give what you give to me, to other people, and figure out how to do that. And yeah, she's incredible.
It's an art in a way, but I think it stems from a deep open-mindedness on the part of everybody. Mm-hmm. And then there's this piece of excitement and wonder. It's all the don't know and all the can't know. And you don't try to say that which you don't know or you can't know. You're sort of alive with the speculation, and so you're never trying to slam dunk any, you're not proselytizing ever. It's
yeah.
just like there's this joie de vivre that's just alive in that sort of a mindset. It's like you're a work in progress, and you're just like, whatever's going to happen, right?
Always. So what would you say is your most admirable and what is your least admirable trait or characteristic?
Boy, that's a hard one. I don't know if I've ever done an inventory of myself that way. I think one of the things that I find that surprises people is what a misanthrope I am, because I tend to be viewed locally or within the state because of that sort of being so out there and involved with everybody as sort of Mr. Bozeman or Mr. Music or something, and this really gregarious and charismatic person. But I really cherish my privacy and my private time. So I've had to be really direct with people, and sometimes it really takes them by surprise where they'll want to forge a friendship. And I have to say straight up, and it's so hard to do, I really... I'm not looking for friends. I mean, you can really hurt somebody's feelings because what they're saying is they have this affection and they want to nurture it. And you're basically saying, no, I don't want to do that. And, you know, I just have a limited amount of time and I need a lot of creative space. My wife always teases me that she said, if anybody had an idea of what a hermit you really are, you know, how much you really like to be alone and how much you protect that space, I think they'd be shocked. So I think, in a way, it's I can't do anything about it because it's just the way that I am. And there's a feature to that where if there's a disassociation with somebody, and I have no control over it. In fact, I used to just divulge this to new acquaintances or friends. I'd say, you know, if things fall apart, there's something that might happen that I have no control over where you will just cease to exist in my field. And I just turn and walk away, and that's the end of it, and I can't do anything about it. I'm really sorry. And with that comes this inadvertent honesty where I can hurt somebody's feelings by saying something that's too direct, that I don't mean it to be hurtful. But yeah. And so those are things that you look and go, geez, I wish I didn't do that, because you know when you've done it. And it's not like part of a script. It's not something that you can weed out. It's just part of that character trait, and so it kind of comes with the character, that cold, that ability to be so cold and aloof when you're imbuing so much warmth and connection. So I think that would be, you know, if I was going to crawl through that and say, you know, what's one thing that I would find if I met me and I knew all this stuff, what would be one thing that I found that was really difficult? It's like, geez, that's just so dichotomous, you know, how can you have that? How can you be this and be so embracing and in the flick of an eye just be completely disconnected? What is that about? Because then it throws the question of authenticity into the mix, and yet the authenticity is still there. So it's very strange. It's a very strange knot to tease apart. In terms of things that I admire, and these don't have anything to do with me either, I have no control over them, is that I just have this deep love of life. You know, just there's this thing that I'm enchanted by it. I think I always have been, ever since I was a little kid. I just have been pretty much unstoppable. And until I had some health crises over the last couple of years, I was just like, I can't believe that I just didn't see anything as impossible.
Yeah.
I just went after it. Like, as I tell my students, whoever said think outside the box, just put you in one. There's no box. You know, and so I've never really felt there was. So it's always sky's the limit.
Nice.
I've always felt Montana is such a great place because I don't know if I could get much freer than I am. I just don't feel constrained at all. I do what I want. I am who I am. I don't feel like I have to modify. I can, you know, if I get into a situation where, as my wife will lean in, up to me and say, you're not being charming, or just to remind me, you know, that there's a place for appropriate behavior, and I might be going a little bit over the edge. So I can bring in the gentility on call if I'm aware of it. But my natural state is to just be there and just have the best time and connect. But if it's a party setting, like it's typical, like a 11th and Grant gala in the fall, we usually have this big gathering of all these underwriters, and it probably looks to other people I'm the most comfortable. I'm just having the best time, just hobnobbing, and it's the last place that I want to be is, you know, going from flower to flower. I'm more likely to find somebody like you and stand over here and just have a meaningful conversation than the shallow tete-a-tete sort of. It's just like, that's almost painful. If I have to do those afterwards, you can understand why Tchaikovsky had that deep agoraphobia. It's just like you're a sensitive, and so you're wide open. And if you open up and things can come in that can hurt you and wound you, and you don't even know what's happening, but you can feel an operant loneliness and disconnection from being in a crowd. It's a funny irony.
Yeah.
And yet my move against that is either to go into the work mode where, like, I'm doing all the dishes, I'm doing all this, you know, I'm disconnected from the group, but I'm doing some functional thing, and so I'm, you know, in that process, or I leave the scene. I'll make a break, a jailbreak. So I've got one grandson who is so sensitive. I look at him and I think, man, when you're a teenager, it's going to be so hard for you, because this is a harsh place. The earth can be so harsh on a heart like yours, and it can be so closed off. So usually when he shows up, you can tell there's just way too many people. So I'll go grab, say, Sam, you want to run away from home? And we'll take off. We sneak around the back of the house and take off and take a hike or climb a tree or do something. And I know that in a way I'm helping him sort of phase into the scene, but I am also using him to help myself with the same issue. I recognize a kindred spirit when I see one. You know, it's this little 8-year-old kid.
That's so funny.
Isn't that funny? It is a really... And I think we all have those behaviors if we're really honest about them. When we look at how, you know, how we interact with others and what is... When you can bring a real substantive and when it's time to do that, and you can't just turn it on, it's not like a switch where you can just engage.
Yeah.
But if you get around folks, and opportunities can come out of nowhere, and you can turn on a dime, and you just recognize it, and you go like, boom, okay, let's do this.
Absolutely. You mentioned that one of the work accomplishments that you're most proud of is Mandelschnamm. That was a big piece.
Wait, you've been combing through the interviews.
I've been combing through,
and that was in 2014. Is that still your proudest work accomplishment? And then the second part of that question is, in all of your life, what would you say is your proudest accomplishment?
Boy, that's hard. It's kind of apples and oranges because, mm-hmm. you know, if you've got kids and there's a bit of that, you know, sort of your offspring and who they've turned out to be as adults and people, you know, that you really enjoy being around and who are bringing something to the planet. So there's that thing. But in terms of creativity, I have a feeling that Mandelstam piece is, I had a fat commission to write it, and it was like, write whatever you want. And so it's ridiculous. I mean, it's never going to get performed. It's just ridiculous. I could record it. If I had a huge chunk of money, I could go in and record one of the orchestras and then use the same orchestra to record the other orchestra because it's two full orchestras, which is nuts. And then there's like a 400-voice choir, and they're in Russian, and they're singing these Pindaric odes of Osip Mandelstam, which are really... really complicated, and it's the subtitle is A Valediction to the 20th Century, so it has this, I took it seriously, and the closest I could come to describing it to somebody was I was doing a landscape of the Gallatin Range, but I was getting every pine needle on every sprig of every tree. I mean, it was that level of detail, and it was just so exhausting. I mean, it was like a real... I really pulled, and I'd come out of a pretty bad health crisis, and so it was my first segue back into full force. The dam had busted, and suddenly, where I hadn't been writing for a long time, I was after this. And then there were funny, back to Joseph Campbell, magic land, things that happened where there was a guy whose research I had read, and his name was Clarence Brown. And he was the head of comparative studies at Princeton. And I'd read all of this stuff by him, and it was so earnest and so beautifully written. It was poeticized, and yet it was scholarly writing. But there was, you know, you could tell that he was, there were ghosts behind the words, you know, it was that kind of writing. And so I wrote a letter of thank you, not knowing if the guy was even alive. But I thought, I have to say thank you to this guy as sort of my seminal research buddy and say, wow, thanks to you, I was able to go into this cavern and mine this ore. So I come home one day, and I've got a phone message on my phone, and it says, hello, Mr. Funk. He said, this is Clarence Brown. And he says, thank you very much for your letter. And he says, as it happens, I'm driving to Seattle to visit my daughter, and I'm going to be spending the night in Bozeman. And if you get a telephone call from the Grand Tree Inn from a very tired older fellow who claims to be me, it probably is. I'd love to meet you. So I'm like, holy crap. You know, this is like this legendary guy. And the piece was done. And so, sure enough, you know, I can't remember what month it was even at this point, but I get this call. And so I head over to the Grand Tree Inn. And here's this very elegant, scholarly guy who's just authored all this stuff that I've, these translations and just this amazing stuff. And I had gotten involved in the Acmeist poets who were Mandelstam, Marina Svetaeva, and Anna Akhmatova. And the three of them particularly were part of the sort of renegade group of poets who were up against the Stalin, Lenin, and then toward the Soviet Union era, post-Tsarist Russia. Very, very dangerous time. And so part of my understanding of Mandelstam had to necessarily include Akhmatova because they were in relationship, not a lover's relationship, but more of a collegial relationship, but a deep poetic connection. And then he did actually have a relationship with Svetaeva. And she has this great line, you who can look into the sun without blinking, is it too much for you to look into my eyes? And it's like, that's who these people are. I mean, they're like hitting home run truths. And it's just every time you read something, you're like, damn. dang, who are these people? And it's rocking my world, right, big time. So I'm meeting Clarence Brown, and he tells me that he was carrying, he went to Russia. He probably was working for the government in some capacity, because he was that kind of like the guy in Russia House. You know, you're not really sure what his segue was, but he was very, very sophisticated, way, way smart, and broad, just massive breadth. But anyway, he had met Mandelstam's wife, and because they had outlawed Mandelstam's poetry, all these people had memorized the poetry, and they would say them, and they kept them alive by saying them, and eventually wrote all these things back down again because they were, like, against the law. She gave him all of the poetry. She gives it to this guy. He brings it back to Princeton, and they hold it in their library. Meanwhile, he meets Akhmatova and becomes a close personal friend of hers, and he's carrying love letters from her to Mitchell Lurie and Isaiah Berlin back to the States. And so he's involved in this world that is an aftershock of the time that they were in, that they're still, we're still kind of in the 60s, 50s and 60s. And so here I'm talking to this guy who's encountered all these things that I only have sort of a mythological connection with. And then the piece had some very unusual pieces, because like I say, I think one of the reasons I'm so proud of it is that I opened the portal big time. So in the last, it's five movements long, and it's for amplified string quartet in addition to the two orchestras and this big choir. And then in the last movement, the weirdest thing came to mind, since we were talking about where do these ideas come from and how do you manifest them. There's this, I'm sort of watching a performance in the future, and I haven't even written the piece yet, but I'm sort of watching a performance of this last movement. And there's this old Russian woman, and she's sitting, suddenly she's sitting in this old chair on the side of the stage in the concert hall while they're performing this thing. And she's sitting there kind of looking out across the crowd. And I don't know what she represents, but I know she has to be in it because she's in the image. And then this Mandelstam-type character comes kind of walking out, and he's hesitant to say anything. But he's like, but he's in costume. He looks like Mandelstam. He's like that era, 1930s, overcoat, Russian, dark sort of visage. There's a huge audience out there. I mean, this piece is going on. Here comes this guy, and he's standing there. And then this young woman, this beautiful young woman, like a muse comes. She puts her hands on the shoulders of this old woman, and she starts to sing across the stage at this guy. And basically, she's telling him, like a muse would inspire, you have to do this, you have to sing. And so then he starts to sing these lines. And I was having dreams of poems that were lost, that were Mandelstam's poetry. And I would write them down, and they're like Mandelstam would write, but they weren't obviously his, as far as I know. I mean, yeah. Who knows? Spooky stuff going on here. So at the end of the piece, there's a scene where the first violinist with the amplified string quartet gets up and walks down behind the conductor to the lip of the stage, and she starts playing the solo line. And then the orchestra gets so loud you can't hear, but she's still playing. And then the second violinist comes and stands right behind her. So now there's two of them, and they're doing the same thing. And the orchestra keeps overwhelming the sound. And then this Mandelstam theater sort of character comes over, and he stands right next to the violinist as if to say, to make sure she's going to keep playing. And I think the line I might have used was, though I lay beneath the ground, my lips are still moving. I mean, that's another one of those real Russian lines. But, I mean, that kind of stuff is so theatrical and so operatic and so completely over the top. But I trusted the piece, and then here I am talking to Clarence Brown, and he's sharing all these stories with me about these people, and it's all like all the beads are getting locked into this DNA almost. You know, it's like a living creature of which I was part.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things where the paper that I had to write on was so big, because I've got so many musicians, I had to have it on an easel. So it's like an artist's easel, and I'm like writing with waterproof ink on vellum paper, and it's just, the score is like, they're like poster size. They're these huge sheets. So in my mind, laughingly, I'm thinking of these altar boys having to turn the pages because they're so big, you know. It's just totally preposterous situation. And yet the music that's there is like, it's really, really powerful.
Well, I hope you get to record it at some point in time.
Well, the cool thing is that, of course, I've heard it because I wrote it.
Right, yeah,
so
you heard it. It's,
I know what it sounds like, you know, and so nobody else gets to hear it. And that's another funny question that I'll get asked where people, I'll have a performance of a piece and they'll say, so when you heard it, did it sound like you imagined it would? And it's like such a weird question. It's like, well, yeah, because I put on paper exactly what I imagined it was supposed to be. And so now it is, you know, unless they completely butcher it, you know, it is what it is. But that piece is so massive. It's just huge. It has a magnum opus feel to it just because, partially because of its size, but partially because of its content. I have no idea why a kid born in Deer Lodge, Montana, suddenly had this affinity with these Russian poets. But I think, you know, the time that I was growing up, it's when you are on the planet and who else is on the planet at the same time and, you know, who you get to hang out with. Spending time with Nadia Boulanger in her apartment in Paris. And looking, you know, she's blind at the time. She's 93, and I'm holding her hand. And I've had a formal letter of introduction that allows me to be, I mean, it's like real old world. We're drinking tea. She's been in this apartment since 1904. I'm looking around at the picture rail, and I'm seeing 18-year-old Stravinsky and 21-year-old Aaron Copland and Arthur Honegger and Darius Milhaud and all these. They look like graduation pictures of these young composers that she midwifed, basically. Into themselves because none of them sound like each other. They all, and so that was part of my question. But I've dropped into history here, and when I first met her, we're talking. She was aware of Svoboda. She had invited him to come and study with her, but the communist government wouldn't let him go. But she doesn't know how old I am or how old I'm not, and so I'm just sitting there talking with her, and she asks me if I'm a friend of Diaghilev, who is the guy who is the impresario with the Russian ballet, who commissions The Rite of Spring and Firebird and, you know, all this stuff that was going on in Paris in the 30s. And I had to explain, no, I was younger. I was a student of Tom's. I'm not in that same thing. But all these things are like tableau because I'm here. I am with Nadia Boulanger, and then Marcel de Manziarli is there, who was the reputedly the greatest organist in all of Europe, and she taught at the Paris Conservatory. And then Madame Jeudenis is the composition and theory teacher from the Paris Conservatory. I've got the opening scene from Macbeth, but instead of witches, they're angels. I've got these like brilliant women who are like these, and I'm in this old apartment with a full pipe organ with 32-foot pipes and two grand pianos and these pictures of all these dudes around the wall, and I'm going like, how do I end up being the pebble that gets thrown in that pond, right? And so then the concentric rings that result, you know, it's all quite phenomenal. And so then you end up starting to take your life very seriously and not seriously at the same time, like we were talking before.
Exactly.
It's synchronous, but we all have these opportunities, and then how much are you paying attention, and what are you going to do about it?
Wow.
You know, so, yeah, I think the Mandelstam piece, it has a whole bunch of stuff that came with it. And after that, then I did a ballet, what's called an opera ballet, where there's one character that sings and everybody else dances their part, and it's on the life of Anna Akhmatova. Mm-hmm. And then I did a song cycle on Marina Tsvetaeva called The Captive Lion. And, you get into those guys' world and you realize that they're in a very oppressive environment, and that I don't think you have to be in an oppressive environment to tap into your poesis, you know, that sort of fountainhead of creativity. But if you are in one of those things and you are a creative person, you will go within because there's no place else to hide. But in Montana, you can go there voluntarily. You can say, okay, I'm going to go plumb my depths. That's my choice. But with those guys, man, you read the kinds of things, like there's a great line that Akhmatova has in her Requiem It's a great big collection of her poems. Well, that's another quote. There's one where she's standing outside Lubyanka prison, and all of these women are waiting to see their sons and their husbands marched off to the gulags. And she's one of them. And there's just like hundreds of women. And the way that she describes it in the English translation is that somebody in the crowd recognized who she was. And they couldn't really touch her because she didn't do anything political. But as far as the people were concerned, she was telling the history, but it was wrapped in the poetry. So she was like the truth teller. And she says, this woman recognized me, and she came up and leaned up to me and said, can you write about this? And she said, I answered yes, and something like a smile passed across what once had been her face. Who even says something like that? I mean, doesn't that hit it? And there's the beauty of poetry. And if it can survive a translation from Russian into English. So you get in a taxi cab in New York, and you've got a Russian driver, and you say, oh, you're Russian. And they say, yeah. And you say, I wrote a piece about Mandelstam, or I wrote a piece about Akhmatova or Svetaeva. They reach into their pocket, and they pull out the complete works. I mean, these guys, it's amazing. I've had that happen hundreds of times. And they've memorized these things. It's like part of their whole liturgy of life. It's not a religious frame. It's a trying to translate the experience into truths that are tenable so you can survive intellectually and spiritually in an untenable situation.
Unreal. You've met incredible people in your time.
God, I've been so lucky.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. One of the funnest ones was I was asked to write a piece of music for the 100th anniversary of this Czech composer, Jan Hanusch. And I had gone to Budapest to have for the PBS guys to film the world premiere of my Violin Alone piece. And so these people from the Czech Republic come down and they start talking to me afterwards about writing this piece in memory of their father. And Mandelstam actually has a line in one of his poems, he whose name is adorned in song is twice blessed. So that's kind of in the back of my mind. I'm thinking this is a great way to memorialize this guy. Play all of his music, but then I'll write a piece that's variations on a theme that he wrote and lift him up another way. So then it turns out that his best friend was Karl Husa, who had left the Czech Republic just before Svoboda did. He left when the communist threat was happening. He escaped and came to the U.S., So the funny backstory on that is that three different times in my life, I was premiering a piece of mine that I was conducting, and Karl Husa was premiering a piece of his that he was conducting, and we're backstage together. That's where we first met. And we'd come to another concert, and here we were again, this wonderful, beautiful old Czech guy. And he had been, for like all the time he left the Czech Republic, they wrote letters back and forth like every week. Jan Hanusch and Karl Husa. So I find out they're going to do Karl Husa's piece on this thing, and so I ask the granddaughter of Jan Hanusch if she has contact with Husa, and she said, yeah, and I said, can you give it to me, because I need to write to him. So she says, yeah. So I write to him, and I said, I don't know if you remember this, and I bring the whole, he totally remembers our time that we bumped into each other, and he's a really important, just died last December, composer, that this beautiful old guy, and I said, you know, here we are again. We're both going to have pieces on the same concert. Are you going to go? Because I'm gonna try to go. And then I had the stroke and the endarterectomy, and they wouldn't allow me to fly. Oh, yeah. And then he was 96, and he couldn't fly. He's just too old. So neither one of us could go. And to me, that's poetic too. Yeah. They're doing our pieces, and where we had been three times prior, backstage with each other and then watching each other go out and conduct our piece. And now we were both having pieces performed on the same concert in Prague that neither one of us can go to because of health issues. It's so poignant.
Yeah.
Because all of that stuff, you know, it all kind of mixes into the salad. It's pretty profound.
Other than your parents, who do you think has been the biggest influence in your life?
That's a really tricky one. You know, weird as it sounds, it's like I've probably been the biggest influence in my life as a translator for my own experience.
Interesting.
So if I sort of bifurcate myself and I look at all the teachers that I've been lucky enough to have, I had to translate what it was they were bringing to the table and turn it into an admixture that was going with what was necessarily the next thing. So I could go through a list of people who all gave me the baton on the next part of the relay race. If there was a person, it would probably be Svoboda, just because our relationship was such an intense, deep relationship. It started out with me as his student, and then I went away. I did some grad school. I lived in the San Juan Islands. I came back to Portland. I started teaching at Portland State. We shared an office. I became his boss. I was the chairman of the music theory program, which was really weird. And it created a little bit of conflict with us, but not much. You know, he didn't have that much of an ego. Once I started getting performances, things got a little bit more tense. But, you know, I taught him how to play two-handed pinochle. And then two-handed pinochle wasn't enough for Tom because he's, like I say, sort of Asperger's-like guy. So we were playing two-handed, two-and-a-half deck pinochle. So we had this ridiculous pile of cards. And he would want to play between classes. So I'd come in after my class, and he'd come in and he'd say, one hand, Eddie Schick, one hand, and we're like playing lightning pinochle, and it's just ridiculous. Because, yeah, and chess, he loved to play chess. But we ended up in a performance ensemble as well. So it was he and I and a guitarist named Brian Johansson, this really fine musician, and the three of us played music. So the time that we spent together in the musical world, but almost in a brotherly relationship was very, very intense. And he really husbanded so much of my craft. He took me into a understanding of the poetics of music that I don't think I would have encountered had it not been for him. Made me aware of the seriousness of the legacy that he wasn't going to give it to me if I wasn't going to carry it and make sure that it didn't get watered down. And the other two were similar. It was less intense in terms of time. But with Tom, God, it was 3 years of private study. And then still, to this day, there's a deep friendship. He had a massive stroke about 4 or 5 years ago, and he's pretty much toast, which is tragic. And we know each other so well. You can imagine, I walk into this room where he's in a personal care center. There's only five people there, and I don't know which one's him. That's how altered he was from that thing. He had a pretty massive bleed out. But we have a fun loving relationship too, because he taught me all these swear words in Czech. And so we'd be walking down the street and I just start saying these words, and he's just like, because to him it would be like he and I are walking in Czech and he's saying English words. It's like, God, don't say that. You know, you can't say that out loud, because I understand what he's saying. So we've always had that sort of playful, childlike friendship connection. That's always been there. And that we have this real high fluting. In fact, this is a great example. He and I and Brian were supposed to play a concert together, and Brian got the flu. And it's like a master class concert. And so Tom and I need to have one more piece on the program. So we decide we're going to co-author a piece. He goes to that corner of the room. I go to that corner of the room. And without talking or playing a note, we both write our part. We come back to the piano, and I play this part, and he plays that part. And it fits together like we sat there and crafted it. It was creepy.
It was really creepy.
It was really amazing. But there was an affinity between us, you know, that was very unusual. And there was a lot of intuitive connection. So it's a bittersweet pill, because he's so critical. Jeez, the last time I had him here in Montana, I was conducting the Helena Symphony for those 8 years, and I got a grant from Meet the Composer in New York to bring him here as a composer in residence, and we were doing a piece of his. So we're driving back up to Helena. We're staying down here. We're driving back up, and he takes out this notebook, and he said, Eddie Schick, I've made a list of everything you're doing wrong in your life. It just starts going through this thing. And it's like, I'm an adult male, you know, this guy who's 10 years my senior is raking me over the coals. And I'm going like, why am I even letting this guy do this, you know? And why is he doing it? You know, what is this territoriality and this sort of superiority game? And at the same time, there is an intensity that comes from that kind of relationship that you can't really find anywhere else. And my Russian friends and my Eastern European friends, their hardest part about living in the States is they don't have those deep friendships where it's like you're joined at the bone marrow, where when they say drop by, they really mean drop by. Whereas Tom, you know, somebody would say, you should come by. And then he would come by. And they're like, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
And he's like, what? You said come by, but they didn't mean it. It's like, how are you? I'm fine. How are you? You know, and so I think the loneliness that happens with those guys, that they're used to these deep tendril connections, sort of soul-to-soul lines. And we sort of fashioned that, you know, that was there. So you learn a lot about connection with somebody who's not family, but you forge this other thing. And really, a lot of my ability to express myself, I mean, the raw material's there, but my ability to put that clearly on the page is because of Tom. Mm. He really pushed my notational system. Got one of my first lessons with him. I came in and I had some sketch, and of course it's very formal in those days. And he says, why is this a quarter note? And I didn't even know what the question meant. I thought, well, why? Because it's a quarter note. It's like, I don't know. It's like, why is the word the? It's just like a dumb question. So I said, well, I don't understand what you mean. I mean, why? What do you mean, why is it a quarter note? And he said, why isn't it a dotted eighth note with a 16th rest and a tenuto marking? In other words, it has the same value, but it's way more specific. So he's saying, if you're going to say something, say exactly what you mean. Don't give some mindless thing. And it pushed me into that corner. And the other great story with Svoboda was that I was studying with him. He was living in William Stafford's house, the great poet laureate. And he was out in Lake Oswego. I was in Portland, and the bus broke down. And I have a lesson at 5 o'clock, and it's like 3:30. I walk from Portland to Lake Oswego. It's like 11, 12 miles. And I'm like speed walking trying to get there. And I get there at 5 after 5. And I ring the doorbell and he opens the door and he said, you're late. And I said, well, the bus broke down, so I had to walk. And he looks at me and he said, leave earlier next time. And he closes the door. And I have to walk all the way back to town. But it was like, and I know now that he didn't really understand what I had said. And yet there was a level of the seriousness of what was going on that was always at play.
Yeah.
I remember you'd never see this in a contemporary university, but I had skipped his class. I was an undergraduate student, and I'd gone down to the sub with some friends or something. And I'm walking down the stairs, and it's like hundreds of students everywhere. And here comes Tom, and he grabs me by the shirt and puts me up against the wall. And he said, why did you miss my class? And I said, excuse me, he said, do you want to be a musician? And I said, yeah. And he said, never skip my class. And it was like, holy crap. But it was like a love gesture. It was like, you know, the guy cares about you. Yeah. So it's like, and I never missed another one of his classes. Not because I thought he was going to beat me up in the hallway, but because, wow, what a gesture.
Was there anything on that list of things that he said you were doing wrong with your life that stick out to you? Or?
Oh, no, they were just silly criticisms. Okay. You know? There are some Eastern European people who think that their solution to life's problems are the solution to life's problems. And so for him, you would never get a cold if you ate peppers and garlic. So if you start having a cold, you should eat pepper and garlic. And you shouldn't eat the following things. And you shouldn't eat them at this time. And he was also a mycologist, so he had all these mushrooms that he was into. Everything that he did was the way life was supposed to be. And if you didn't do exactly what he did, you were not doing life the way life was supposed to be. And so at one point he said, you know, he said, this is where it got really personal. He said, you know, every piece of music that you've written has a lousy ending. That's a huge thing to say. And so And it kind of sort of slapped me, you know, and I thought, what are you talking about? And I said, well, what about Legitza? And he said, well, that has a beautiful ending. And I said, well, what about Rioter? And he said, well, that has a beautiful ending. And I just kept going that through every piece that I'd written and basically made him retract what he had said. But it was such a, if I'd taken it personally, if I hadn't had the courage to just, because we're driving all the way to hell and I'm in the car with this guy and I don't have an ejector seat button, which I wish I'd had. It's like, you know, out of my car, you. But, you know, he's doing this thing and I don't know why he's doing it. So then the question, of course, if you're a thinking person, comes into your mind, why is he doing this? You know, is there a competitive thing? Have I crossed a line? Have I trespassed? And it was a little contentious. So I'm conducting the Helena Symphony, and I've got a metronome marking, and he goes, Eddyshek, you're going too slow. And so I say, the metronome marking is 96. He goes, that's right. And I hold up the metronome, and I say, it's at 96. And I played it, it's exactly the tempo I'm at. And he said, then we should change it. But it was just like that the whole time. It was like, God, I'm like mud wrestling with this guy. And, you know, here I'm thinking, these guys in Helena are going to have such a powerful experience with my mentor. We're playing his piece, and they're just going to be lifted up. It's just going to be such a glorious thing for them to be with a living composer of such stature. And so we play through his piece. And so I give him a chance to talk. And I've already said, you know, this is a community orchestra. These are just Montana folks. They're of varying degrees. They've got varying quality of instruments, but they really love what they're doing. And it's taken me a long time to kind of get a healing vibe going and get everybody on the same page and doing something positive. So I said, Tom, would you like to say something? And he comes up to the podium and he stands there and looks around at the whole orchestra and he said, what you're doing is like a bad dream. He said, you're killing me. And I'm looking at their crestfallen faces, and I'm going, oh, God. He's got a notebook for everybody in the orchestra. He's just being such an ass. But at the same time, I know this guy so well, and I love him. You know, I understand what he's doing, but I can't translate all that to these people. He's just destroyed their whole life force, and he's just completely thrown buckets of dung on them, and I'm going like, oh God. The only modeling that got us through was that we just stayed on it and we played the piece, and it ended up being a good performance, and they brought their A game and we all survived. But they could kind of see that here I am, the conductor, and here's this guy who's like diminishing me in front. I mean, he's like just trying to collapse me psychically. And yet I have to figure out a way to survive this without getting into battle. And so you have to say, okay, what am I doing here? And you go, I'm going to model character and integrity. I have to figure out a way to do grace and dignity against this guy who's behaving badly. But there's nothing I can do. They're just going to have to. So I could explain to them later when he wasn't there. I said, you know, some composers are real eccentric and they're real moody and they say things and they don't realize what they said. And I said, you know, when I was in undergraduate school and Tom was my theory teacher, one of my best friends was a music major, and Tom was passing back the homework, and he gets to this kid and he holds his homework page in over his desk, and he goes, and this one is like a nightmare. And he drops it and it kind of floats to the table, and he said, you should think of a different major.
Wow.
And so the guy that I'd known for a long time quits music. And in retrospect, Tom was right. I mean, he really didn't belong in music, but it was such a harsh way to do it. So years later, when I became really close with Tom, I said, you know, Kurt Gustafson, that day that you held his thing up and you dropped it and said, this is like a nightmare and that you should switch your major, he stopped doing music from that point. And he just looked like I'd hurt his feelings. Like he couldn't imagine that he had actually done that. Because he probably thought he was being funny, or he didn't realize. Just unaware. But at the same time, you know, I guess if I rake through it all, he was a real powerhouse. Because it's always a mixed bag. It's not like who can you dredge up that had the most positive. It's like who was the most comprehensive impact. Definitely. And there's some powerfully negative things and some powerfully positive things. And yet we survived it all.
Yeah.
And we had some serious fights. And at one point I wrote him a letter and I said, you know, you've never ever called me on the phone. You've never written me a letter. It's always been one-sided. I've always been seeking you out. And you get offended that we don't have a friendship, but you're not in the friendship. You just want a sycophant. And I got it. Like, I went totally rogue. And he came to my house crying. He had no idea that he was that selfish. He had no idea of his behavior, and hence the behavior, because he's just oblivious. Had no siblings. Was a kid who didn't talk till he was five. And the first thing that came out of his mouth was he sang a Bach fugue subject. And his dad was a huge scientist, inventor, who the CIA actually helped them get out of Czechoslovakia. Wow. Dramatic story. They tried to escape seven or eight times, and they'd always gotten stopped, but everybody pretended like they weren't really trying to escape. It was just a misunderstanding. And finally the CIA came in and helped them get out. And Tom's dad had invented the largest computer in the world, and it was self-correcting. So the deal was, we're going to get you out. You bring your plant. And they made him the head of computer science at UCLA.
Wow.
Upon his... But meanwhile, Tom's 18, and he's in love with this girl whose dad's in the Communist Party. He's not supposed to tell anybody they're escaping. He tells her because they're in love. So Jana, who's also a very dear friend and who takes care of him now, gets a letter from somebody named Margaret Herzog. And basically, they know that the Communists are going to read all of her mail. And somebody catches her on the street and said, you're going to start getting these letters from this woman in Vienna. His name is Margaret Herzog, and it's going to be like she's your old friend, even though you've never met her before. It's going to be set up in a way that, you know, you haven't seen each other for years. So when she invites you to come to Vienna to visit her because they've read all your letters, it's going to look like a natural outgrowth. And you need to go there, and from that moment, they'll put you on a plane, and you're going to go to the States. This is how we're going to orchestrate the escape. So she tells her mom that she's going to go spend the night with a friend, and she never comes back because she's going to Vienna. So I'm going to Vienna years later because, you know, while it was still communist Czechoslovakia, there were warrants out that if Tom's mother and father would have both been death penalty, Tom would have been life in prison. And so he couldn't travel. If he did travel, he had to have bodyguards so they wouldn't kidnap him. It was that kind of it's spy thriller stuff,
holy
right?
Shit.
So Tom and Jana want me to go to Vienna and find Margaret Herzog and thank her for her role, because Jana had never been able to thank her for getting her out, this young, late teenager who comes, you know, 3 years later and marries Tom and doesn't speak any English, and suddenly she's in the United States, you know, just like a fish out of water. And so I'm supposed to go meet this woman, and I can't find her. I find the name, I find the address, but that address doesn't exist. And I kind of get a warning from somebody who said, you know, you're an American person and you really don't understand what's going on in the world, so don't be too flip about trying to find people, or because you're getting into territory that you really don't understand. I mean, I got a clear warning.
Wow.
And I thought, whoofta, this is not like TV. This is like getting killed in an alley type stuff. So I backed off. But, you know, you end up in these situations because of who you meet and when you meet them and what's going on. And it changes your worldview.
Yeah.
We're so naive. Montana kid, I get a residency in the former East Germany, and I'm the composer, the American composer, the first American and composer at this arts residency, at this Kunstlerhaus. And I'm meeting all these people from all over the world, and they're all like real big name people. And like a Montana kid, we're all sitting around drinking beer, and I say, so where'd you grow up? Because I know where I grew up. We used to play kick the can and, you know, all these games that kids play, and all these people grew up on the run. They're all refugees during the World War II. And they're living in the forest, and they're hiding under bridges, and they all had scars on their wrists. And it's like, oh, my God, my experience and their experience are not the same experience. And I'm naive because I've never been in a town that's been flattened by bombs. Yeah. Yeah, and it's just, You just keep getting slapped around, you know, by this stuff. It's pretty amazing. But it informs your process.
It does.
And, you know, then you understand more seriously when Tom was asking me, why isn't this a dotted half note with a 16th note rest and a tenuto marking? It's that important to be that clear about what it is that you're saying. You're not fooling around here. You're telling the truth. Or if it's funny, you're telling a joke. But tell it perfectly. Don't screw around. So it makes you accountable for your poetics.
Your stories are incredible. This is an amazing interview.
Well, I don't get to tell them to anybody. I mean, who cares about
this
stuff?
We might have to do part two of this. That's cool with you.
You know, it's one of those things where, you know, really nobody wants to know this kind of stuff, and yet where we started this and where we kind of went, you know, and into this labyrinth, then all of this stuff is all part of it. You know, it's all part of a weave, and each one of us is in the process of becoming ourselves, you know, this sort of self-actualization. And the recipe that's turned me into me has some really unusual pieces to it, you know, that are just very singular. Mm-hmm. And then if you're paying attention, then they're going to be all to your advantage. They're going to make you, they're going to make me a better teacher for some structural engineering student at Montana State who's taking my enjoyment of music class. And I say something a certain way, and it's going to lace into their memory in some fashion that just hits them for the rest of time. And I have no control over that, but I have the ability to turn that sentence into that dotted eighth note with a tenuto marking. I know exactly how to be eloquent and when to say what. It's my whole ability as a teacher is really a reflection of what I do as a composer and what I do as a performer. Mm-hmm. It's all kind of the same thing. You're accountable for what you do and say.
With teaching and everything that you do, composing, performing, 11th and Grant, being a grandfather, what do you think is your favorite thing, or what do you think is the thing that brings you the most joy?
Well, you know, the cool thing is that I get to do it all. I get to be a presenter, a performer, a creator, a composer, a teacher. So from the music side, I have every possible vector to be able to impart this. It's a really cool thing, the way that things have turned out. As far as the, I mean, if I go into fatherhood, you know, being the father to my kids, because I'm a creative, you can't just do inflatable dad, you know, you have to do this like real. And so the kids will tell you, I mean, it's just, it's in a way it's a little bit dangerous because you create a myth of your own fatherhood. But with my kids, from the time they were like little, I started doing these birthday treasure hunts.
Nice.
And it starts out where they can't read yet, so you've just got index cards with pictures, you know, and they go to this picture and it has a picture of where the next clue is hidden. But it ends, like with Aaron, my oldest boy, who's in his early 40s now. His last treasure hunt was when he was 30. He said, I want the treasure hunt to end all treasure hunts. It was over hundreds of square miles. It involved the state police. I mean, somebody pulling you over while you're driving down the freeway in Oregon, and he's terrified of the police. And they say, can I see your operator's license? And he, yes, sir. And he goes, Aaron Funk? And he goes, yes. And he said, I have a clue for you. I mean, that kind of stuff.
Wow.
And so we've got, you know, rappelling off cliffs, and we've got clues that are tied to a string that's weighted, that's in a waterproof bag off of a piece of driftwood in a waterfall. They're coming all the way down this cliff, and they have to, you know, and they're all in rhyming quatrains. I mean, code, secret codes, cryptography. So the treasure hunts are famous with the kids because they always had friends that went on these treasure hunts. And they're totally silly because they all involve the Crimson Chest, which is just a red Coleman camp cooler that becomes, it becomes the Crimson Chest at birthday time. And it's always at home. It's always, so the journey is always like T.S. Eliot's We shall not cease in our explorations, but set ourselves off in different directions, finding mm-hmm. ourselves at the place that we started knowing that place for the first time. So the treasure is in the crimson chest, which is always at home. But there's this long process, and the kids get to choose the subject of the treasure hunt, or got to when we were doing these full on. So one of Toby's, my son who lives in Greenwich Village now, as an example, was he wanted Mission Impossible. That was his theme. So I go to the Kmart store down here, and I find this girl in the camera department, and I said, so I'm a dad, and I'm doing a treasure hunt for my kid, and these boys are going to come in here. They're like 10 years old, and they're going to say IMF. And I said, can you do a little bit of theater with me? And she said, yeah, what do you want me to do? And I said, this is a tape recorder that's going to have a message on it. I need you to put it in the storeroom. And when they come in, I need you to look both ways and take these boys back to the storeroom and give them the tape recorder and just let it go. So meanwhile, one of Toby's friends, I pull him aside and I say, okay, here's the deal. I'm going to have this thing, and I'm going to do the clue on the tape in Russian. And they're not going to understand what I said. So you need to say, wait a minute, that's Russian. My mom's Russian. And, of course, they're all going to buy this. I think the kid's name was Barry Berg. And so then you tell them what it means. And so I'm out in the car right in the parking lot. So backing up, they're in the house, and there's balloons all over the room. But in one of the balloons, there's a clue. But they don't realize it yet. So they're just kind of looking around, waiting for the thing to start. Somebody says, wait a minute. There's something in that balloon, and they pop the balloon, and there's a phone number, and they call the phone number, and it's a friend of mine who I said, if you get a telephone call between 10 and 11 in the morning, you need to answer your phone FBI. And when they say IMF, you need to say Kmart Camera Department and hang up. So the person on the other, they get this thing, and they call up, and she goes, and hello, the FBI. They go, IMF. And Joe says, Camera Department, Kmart, click. And so, I set up the thing, but they're in such a suspension of disbelief that Toby comes running and he said, can you get us to Kmart? You know, we need to go to Kmart. It's Camera Department. I said, okay, we can do that. So we all get in the car and we drive in there, and they go in and they see this girl and she plays the tape, and they come out and they say, we need to go to Spanish Creek. And I've got these squirt guns that are hidden in culvert pipes that are supposedly full of plasma that will kill the aliens that are invading the Earth. And it's just totally ridiculous. But it's like 9 hours of ridiculousness where they're going on this long journey and they're gathering together clues that are going to guide them back to the Crimson Chest.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So there's, you know, it's not like if you're a creative person, then you do creative stuff because a treasure hunt's for free, you know, and so I know what's going to happen. All of my kids, now that they're having kids, they're going to start doing these treasure hunts. And it's all because I was just responding to, well, we don't really have any money to do a fancy party, but this isn't going to really cost anything. We'll just buy some party favors and put them in this thing. And so you know what I'm... So
absolutely.
There's the thing about the grandfather part of it is that now I wish I had the energy that I had when I was dad, and I could do that kind of stuff. So I'm kind of waiting for the healing to kick in so I can kind of emerge as the sort of my nickname. My grandfather nickname is Gandhi, and because we were supposed to choose Gina as Nana, and I'm Gandhi. And so my youngest daughter's kids, Oscar and Sam the delicate Sam, came up to me one day at one of the house things, and they said, we figured something out. And I said, what is it? And they said, Gandhi's short for Gandalf, isn't it? And I said, yeah, it is. Don't tell anybody. So the game is afoot.
That's
you know,
awesome.
We're already playing. So it's really, you know, everything. You know, just whatever you're engaged in, you're just engaged in it.
Yeah.
You don't miss it.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity.
Other than everything that we've talked about, is there something about you that not many people know?
Probably not. You know, I think it's a weird thing to be a composer who was trained by three Eastern European composers who are carrying a very serious legacy forward. This goes back to Beethoven and Mozart. I mean, they're making sure that this torch It's like an Olympic torch of composition is being carried forward. And so I've been pulled into a way of writing that is involves very high poetics. And it's very different from what other composers that I'm around are involved in. And so there's a funny dynamic. The music that I write is very, it's not contemporary by history of music standards, but for people in America that aren't familiar with what happened in classical music in the 20th century, it sounds pretty far out and unapproachable. And so people will really like me, but then they hear my music and they don't like it and they feel awkward. They don't know what to do. And so they're like, don't really want to go there. You know, it's just like, like even at the dog park a couple weeks ago, there's this guy and he said, oh, I saw the violin alone. He said, that's an amazing violinist. He said, but the music was just crap. It's just awful. And I don't know if he knew that I wrote it or not, but I, you know, it's not something that I'd never heard before. And I thought, you know, it's okay. You know, you can like me and not like the music, but at the same time, I am the music. So that really is me at the most complicated formula of actually who I am. Mm-hmm. So it's an awkward thing. It's kind of like I'm in a world of music when music has become a commodity. People turn on the lights, they turn on the music, and they want the music to be pleasant, or they have sort of an idea of what they think music is. Yeah. And what I'm doing isn't that. You know, there are dotted half notes with 16 notes for us. I mean, it's that specific. And so even like next week, or on the 21st, a week from tomorrow, the MSU Symphony is playing a piece of mine. And I'm going to teach my Wanderlust students, these retired folks, how to listen to that piece of music. So those guys are going to have a great time because they're going to kind of have a code to understand how it works. Uh-huh. Some of the audience is going to be really uncomfortable with the dissonance treatment, and it's just not like the stuff they're used to using. Yeah. And then they're in an awkward position because after the concert, they don't really want to come and say, wow, I loved the piece, because they didn't love it. They hated the piece. And, you know, here I am standing there. And so there's this awkward moment. And so it's kind of like, do you diffuse it or do you just let the cognitive dissonance hang? Mm-hmm. And since I subscribe to a lot of what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, don't be so quick to try to resolve cognitive dissonance. Let it work its work. So I kind of secretly, amusingly, you know, I enjoy it. But at the same time, one wishes that that which you're really saying in earnest would have connection, but we write music for 50 years hence. So,
right. Yeah.
My audience is young, you know, people who are pretty open-minded.
Who's somebody who's a part of your life, who you know, who you admire? What do you admire about them? And what's one or two questions that you would ask them?
Man, I mean, the people that I admire, I've asked them the questions. I guess there's, I mean, some of it is, and sometimes there are questions that you might want to ask, but the question would break the spell. And so that guy I was talking about who told me to go study with Penderecki, he's 95 years old. He's a composer. He had pretty much stopped writing because he became the head of the School of Music at the Music Conservatory in Louisville before he came to Portland State and became our department chair. And I just, he's brilliant. I mean, he's so well-read. I think I'm left-leaning politically. Mm-hmm. Nothing compared to this guy. And, I mean, he is so, he has his finger on the pulse of the whole thing. And he's so well-read. And he listens to way more complicated avant-garde music than I do. Mm-hmm. And I've got pretty sophisticated tastes. And he's always like, taking me to the hoop. I just called him the other day out of the blue because I'd had a strange dream about him. So I called him up and we talked on the phone, and he's a very strange guy. I've never asked him when I used to go to teach his son, the Asperger's boy. Oftentimes when I would show up, he'd be out in his forest. He had like 80 acres of forest in Northwest Hills of Portland. And he'd be up there in a hooded sweatshirt with his wellies on, maybe up a tree. I mean, he was kind of like a Merlin-type character. And I never really asked him what drew him out into the woods. I mean, that would be an interesting thing. I think, you know, I just imagining myself asking him that question and seeing him sort of smile at me as his real sky blue eyes and just saying, Well, you already know the answer to that question. But his wife, when she was alive, she was another mystical person. One day I went to teach Danny, and I got out there and just pulling under their driveway. It was like leaving the earth and going into another planet. And he wasn't quite ready to start, so I'm having tea and talking to her. And I said, "So you were in my dream last night?" She said, "Yeah, I know." It's like, that's a really weird response.
Yeah.
And she said, "We were sitting on hilltops and holding our hands in the air and stopping the war." And that's exactly what the dream was. And it was like so bizarre. It's like seeing a flying saucer or something. You can't really share that with somebody else.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we had a connection, you know. And it's the same with him. He's much more pragmatic, much more academic and scholarly. You know, he's a Harvard-Princeton doctorate. There's a funny story that sort of opens the can of worms where we were all really afraid of Dr. William P. Stolniker III. He was this guy. Mm-hmm. When I was an undergraduate student, he wore bow ties and tweed, and he carried around huge stacks of books, and he had this ridiculous vocabulary. We would just write words down and go look them up after the lecture to try to figure out what the hell he just said. And one day, I was in the men's room on the top floor of the music building, and it was Friday afternoon, so everybody's pretty much gone. It's like 4:30 in the afternoon. And the way that thing was set up was there was a middle sink that didn't work. No water would come out of the things. But if you turned the hot water on the leftmost sink just a little bit, and you turned the cold water on the right one just a little bit, and you started manipulating the valves on the middle sink, you got this ridiculous cool sound from the pipes buzzing in the wall and going, so it's like making, so I'm doing this, I'm in there doing this, thinking that I'm all by myself, and in walks the dreaded, ever pedantic Dr. William P. Stolniker, and I see him in the mirror, and he's got this ridiculous stack of books, and I just think to myself, I can't stop, because I'm like, I've got it perfectly set up, and I've got like an octave and a sixth interval. So I'm just doing this. And to my shock, he drops all the books on the floor, and he runs around, and he's beating rhythms on the bathroom stalls and hitting toilet paper rolls and flushing toilets and kicking doors shut and slamming toilet lids. And we do this duet for like 10 minutes where I'm doing this thing, and he's going, bam, bam, da-dam, bam, blah, 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 flush, flush. We're doing this piece. And then he goes over, and his like tie is crooked, and his hair is all messed up, and he picks up all of his books, and he leaves. We never talked about this for like 20 years. We never talked about that event, because we weren't friends at that point. He was, you know, our department chair, and I was just a student. Later, I became faculty. Later than that, I became friends of the family. And so I had arranged for a couple of recordings of his music through my own connections to try to... I mean, he's a brilliant composer, and he just had kind of sidestepped his own career. And so I had set him up for a recording, one recording with the Czech Philharmonic, the Radio Symphony. And the other was with the Seattle Symphony, Richard Stoltzman, and Gerard Schwartz conducting. So it's a brilliant album. It's just a great album. Mm-hmm. But on the album, there's this piece, and it says Preludes and Fugues, Part 1 and Part 2. So you get to Part 2, and you're reading the liner notes, and it said, "This is a replication of a duet that I played in the men's room in the music building with Eric Funk." And he had taken that piece that we had played and turned it into this piece of music for this record. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So I performed it at MSU, and I told the kids, I was conducting the orchestra at the time, and I said, "This, we're going to have this composer is going to come, and we're going to do this piece." And I said, "This is the story." And they're all looking at me like, right, you know, he's totally making this up. And so my concertmaster goes up and catches Bill up in the lobby before the concert. And he comes down to the orchestra and goes, "It's true. It's a true story." And so I told the audience, and I said, "You know, this is a very unusual piece. It's a little improvisation that the composer and I did when I was an undergraduate student and he was my department chair, and he's turned it into this piece of music." And yeah, I mean, you know what I'm saying? So there are things that I've never asked him literally. I've asked him figuratively, or I've not asked them, but I think I kind of know the answer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic.
That's great. Well, Eric, I want to thank you for the talent and the charisma that you, and the beauty that you bring to this community, to this world. Like I said at the beginning, you're very accomplished, and it's incredible to hear more of your story. And thank you so much for sharing with me.
Thank you, Stephen.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, for me too.